There we go. Okay, so today I'm finally going to get around to doing some dynamics in the sense of ergodic theory rather than just talking about dynamical degrees and things like that. Try and get clear. So I'm going to start with X is a compact, let's say projective surface, so it embeds in Pn for some large n, and F is a meromorphic map. And so the point of my first talk is you have this bound for the topological entropy of F. It's less than or equal to the log of the max of, in this case, just lambda 1 and lambda 2, where lambda j is the jth topological degree. Okay? So this is this Gromov entropy bound. In the case where you're holomorphic, you actually have the reverse inequality by Hard theorem of Yamdin. You can still ask, does this also hold in general? Okay. Well, the approach, the sort of approach that I want to promote here toward answering this question, to answering it affirmatively, is to try to get the reverse bound to resorting to invariant measures. Okay. So if mu is an F invariant probability measure, on X, you can define an entropy just associated to mu, H of, well, how about this? Let's put mu and F on an equal footing here. Okay? You can define the entropy of F relative to mu or something. Okay, and I'm not going to define it, all right? I think maybe Bitalan is going to do that for us, but I won't use the definition, and it's a little involved, so I'll skip it. What I'll point out is you have for continuous maps, you have a variational, what's called a variational equality, which actually is just only an inequality for meromorphic maps. So you have a variational inequality that just comes fairly easily, that H mu F is less than or equal to the topological entropy of F. Okay, so now the scheme becomes clear. I'm going to try to cook up an invariant measure for which you have equality here, and then you've got the reverse bound. For topological entropy, okay? Really what I'm interested in is constructing a natural invariant measure, and this is sort of a selling practice here to point out the connection with entropy.
So it's a big inequality holds always?
Always.
For meromorphic maps in K-dimensionals?
Right. Yeah, as long as you can sort of make sense of what it means for mu to be an invariant measure. None is known right now. I guess the point is I'd like to know that was true, and I'd like to know that there actually is a measure that realizes the equality in general here. Okay, so how to construct such a mu. So the idea to get a measure of maximal entropy is to try to do it in some sense geometrically. So is to realize mu as a limit of codimension J varieties where lambda J is the largest dynamical degree. Okay, so, well, you've only got two of them in this case. And I'll point out that when lambda 2 is bigger than lambda 1, the issue, as far as I'm putting it here, is settled at this point. So this is a theorem. In effect, it's the last theorem in a long line of theorems, beginning at least with Fornes and Sibenion, really maybe going back to Leibovitch, Frey, Lopez, Mann, yay, before them, or even Brolin in the 60s. But the last word on the subject, I think, is due to Gedge in an Annals paper from a few years ago. And it says that there exists an invariant measure mu on x. So I forgot the hypothesis. If lambda 2 is the larger larger dynamical degree, there exists an invariant measure mu on x such that mu is the limit as n goes to infinity of the sum of the point masses over pre-images of a given a fixed P normalized by the number of such pre-images. And for almost every P in X. Okay, so this is the equidistribution measure that Nassim's been talking about in the holomorphic setting for the past couple of days. And the point here is that you have it in the meromorphic setting. Okay, so fine. So you have this equidistribution measure, and it's the right one because mu is the entropy of this thing. Is log lambda 2. Okay, that's more or less automatic once you get the measure. Right? Follows some sort of general dynamical principles. So the thing is, the thing I want to stress is you get it in a kind of geometric fashion. You just pull back points, codimension 2 things. All right. So what I want to focus on in the rest of my talk then is the case where lambda 1 is the larger dynamical degree, and in that case, it's a little trickier to imagine how this is going to work because you want to pull back codimension 1 things, this time curves. And these are naturally not measures, but 1-1 currents. Okay, so you have to think for a little bit about how you're going to go from this to measures. And I think there's no better way to illustrate the idea than to show at least one picture. So I meant to show this picture on the first day, but better late than never. Okay, so hit the right button here. Maybe turn down some lights. Okay. This looks like I've gotten every light except the one I wanted to there. So I'm going to be stubborn. Ah, there we go. Yeah, we'll just do that for a sec. Okay, so this is a picture associated to a very particular map. Here's the map. All right, the formula is totally irrelevant as far as you're concerned. It's a map in two variables, though. And this is what's going on actually in R2. right? It's not actually complex, it's real. So this is a particularly nice situation that the picture looks so good in the real. And that what you're seeing here is red and green, and the red is what happens if you just take a random line and pull it back forever and ever under the map. Eventually, everything converges to this red line. And the green is what happens if you take a random line and push it forward forever and ever, okay? And when you see this picture, you realize that you know what your invariant measure needs to be. It needs to be the set of intersections here. So that's the idea. You want to sort of pull back one line, push forward another line, distribute point masses all over the intersections, and hope that that converges to something, all right? And in this case, it certainly does look that way. So this sort of illustrates the idea when the first dynamical degree is larger. This is actually an invertible map, so lambda 2 is 1. And lambda 1 is like the golden ratio or something. But I have one ulterior motive in putting up a picture like the two ulterior motives. One, I like to show off this picture. But the more respectable ulterior motive is to emphasize that you know, even though we have a lot of general theorems and stuff, I think it's really worthwhile to understand nice examples in a lot of detail, and that's a good way to get started if you want to think about complex dynamics. For instance, in this particular one, you can prove that on the complement of the, is it the red curve, the green curve? Complement of the green curve. Complement of the red curve. Complement of the red curve, you take any point and you map it forward. Well, actually it bounces back and forth a lot, but eventually it just kind of goes down and to the left. Okay, so everything in the complement, the iterates of the map are really tame in the complement. That's much better than what you expect for general maps. So, you know, in particular examples, you can do a little better here. All right, but back to the general case. I'm going to get rid of this. Off. So now I'm going to suppose for the rest of the talk that lambda 1 is the larger of the dynamical degrees. Okay? That F is algebraically stable, that is, taking iterates commutes with doing pullback, algebraically stable. And in fact, I'm cheating a little here. Usually I'm just going to assume the thing is birational. All right? Because it's just easier to explain what's going on. I'll make a few asides occasionally about non-invertible maps and just point you to some papers on the archive. Where the case of non-invertible maps with lambda 1 larger than lambda 2 is treated in lots of gory detail. Okay, I mean, it's quite involved, really. Let's just use that as a working assumption on lambda 2. So the first theorem is just an equidistribution theorem for forms rather than a hypersurfaces. And I can't even say it yet. So recall that there exists classes theta plus, theta minus, and F such that F upper star theta plus is lambda theta plus, and F lower star theta minus, just by taking inverses, is lambda theta minus. Lambda is lambda 1. Okay, so recall those things. And these guys are essentially unique up to scaling. I'll just skip the scaling. All right. you could normalize in various ways. Okay, so the first theorem is that there exists a positive closed 1-1 current T plus, such that for every smooth representative omega of theta plus, we have f to the n star omega over lambda to the n converges to T plus. Okay. Now, Nassim gave the basic outline of the argument for this yesterday. In the holomorphic case, there's a twist in the meromorphic case. So I won't say a tremendous amount about this, but let me say something. So proof. So assume first you can take omega to be Kähler. This really is an assumption. Just because you're an F class does not mean you're represented by a Kähler form, because on the edge of the cone, so the NF classes are the closure of the Kähler classes, but they're not all Kähler classes. So first assume you can take omega Kähler. Then you have S star omega minus lambda 1 omega. Maybe it's better to put the lambda 1 here, is ddc of gamma, where gamma is some essentially plurisubharmonic function, and you can normalize so that it's less than or equal to 0. However, it can still be unbounded the other way. It will be unbounded the other way in general. This is a problem. All right. So anyhow, you have, using this telescoping argument that Nassim outlined, okay, what you get from this is that f to the n star omega over lambda 1 vn is omega plus ddc gn plus, where gn is a sum of pullbacks of gamma. So gn plus is like the sum from j equals 0 to n minus 1, I think, of gamma composed f to the n over lambda 1 to the n. All right? So these are also nice, essentially plurisubharmonic functions. Modulo omega, they're all plurisubharmonic functions. They're all negative. So you have two possibilities. That sum converges, or it goes uniformly to minus infinity. So you need to know gn plus does not go uniformly to minus infinity. Okay? So the way to prove this is a great trick that you do here due to Siebenny. And the trick is that it's not so hard to cook up some invariant positive closed one current in the class. It's just sort of general averaging nonsense or something. So if you have F star S is lambda 1 S for some positive closed 1-1 current representing the class theta plus, necessarily representing that class, then S equals omega plus ddc U, and you can show, after you fiddle with some additive constants, that gn plus is bigger than or equal to u for every n. End of story. It doesn't go to minus infinity. Okay? So this is, I won't actually show it, but this is the idea. All right? So that takes care of things in the case where you have a Kähler class. Right? So what if it's not Kähler? So if theta plus is not Taylor. There are a couple ways you can go, particularly in the bimeromorphic case, but the latest version of this is you can use the following theorem. This is in the paper with Dujardin and Gedge, This is the first of the papers, DEG1. So there exists a positive closed 1-1 current, which I will stubbornly continue to call omega, representing theta plus, such that omega is DDCU locally with U bounded. Okay, so it's essentially as good as a Kähler form. It has a, the thing has bounded local potentials. It's not smooth, but it's good enough to make this argument work. All right. So then the next, so this gets the theorem. Yeah, all right. So then if you have a general smooth form, you can just compare it with omega by writing the difference as DDC of something and go on. Okay. So this is where I draw the square. Okay, so that takes care of this theorem. So the next thing, that theorem is not really good enough for dynamics. You need to do a little better. Ultimately, you need to be able to relate things back to Kähler classes, all right, even if theta plus is not itself represented by Kähler classes. And then you need the next theorem. Everything here, I guess, I mean, you can find this in DDG. It's a little easier in the birational case. So I'm going to stop doing attributions here. So theorem, if omega is any Kähler form, then okay, because theta plus is the unique class corresponding to the largest eigenvalue of F star, the class of omega under iteration is no question about what happens to that converges to theta plus. But in fact, the sequence of currents also goes to theta plus. So, or also goes to C plus, where, if you care about such things, C is the intersection of theta minus with omega. Okay? Right, so you can, so this theorem, the content of this theorem is you don't need to start with something with the right cohomology class. All right, again, if you assume theta plus is also represented by a Kähler form, this isn't too hard because then this Kähler form will be dominated by some multiple of the other one, and then you can just appeal to that to save yourself. If theta plus is not represented by a Kähler form, proving this, you essentially get L1 convergence of potentials by a fairly delicate volume estimate argument. I'm not going to repeat the details here, but they're, I don't know. It took me a while to think of. So, anyhow, so I'll just, I'm not going to say anything about how the proof of that goes. Okay. So why do I care about omega being a Kähler form? So from the Kähler form, so this is Siebenys's point, is that once you can get convergence for Kähler forms, you get convergence for codimension one subvarieties pretty quickly. So the next sort of corollary of this is that if, so I'm assuming I'm in the projective algebraic setting, so if, let's say, X is an embedding, and H is a random hyperplane section, then F to the n star of H over lambda 1 to the n, considered as current, is going to converge to a multiple of t plus. Okay, and this you get by taking the Kähler form here to be the restriction of the Fubini-Studi form, and you use the fact that the Fubini-Studi form is really just an average of hyperplanes. All right, so this is not too big a deal. This is actually, however, since you're in the room, let me point out that it may not be too big a deal, but nobody thought of it before Rusakowski and Schiffman did, and they drew the rest of our attention to this fact. So this goes back to an idea of Rusakowski. And Schiffman. Okay. So what's next? Okay, so next comes something I really want to focus on a little more. This is totally not due to me at all, so I'm talking about somebody else's work, but I think it's really cool and deserves a lot of attention. All right, so the next theorem is because of this corollary, T plus is what's called laminar. All right, I have to define that. But if you remember the picture I had up just a little bit ago, maybe you'll understand what I mean. It's not just a positive closed 1-1 current. What it looks like is a foliation in geometric terms, okay? And it's really a foliation cross a measure in some sense. Okay, so let me try to be halfway careful about the definition here. I doubt it'll be all the way careful. So definition, T plus is laminar if there exist disjoint polydisks, if for every epsilon greater than zero, there exist disjoint polydisks called them PJ in X, and you'll like this, uniformly laminar currents TJ on PJ such that T plus minus the sum, so T plus is greater than or equal to the sum and the mass of the difference is less than epsilon. All right. So that's a pretty good approximation of the definition, I think, except it just defers this thing to another definition here. Okay, so you can, if the current is well approximated with somewhat nicer currents. And what does uniformly laminar mean? So T on PJ is uniformly laminar if T can be expressed as an integral of currents of integration over disks, so say delta alpha integral of alpha against some measure d nu of alpha, where each delta alpha is a graph in PJ. Okay, so the picture is something like this. Here's a PJ. Okay, and you've got all these delta alpha in here, which, actually what I should say is I don't want them to intersect either. These guys are disjoint graphs in PJ. Okay? So you have a bunch of things like that, and they all come from some family, and you can let your family basically just be indexed by intersections with some vertical disk. And then you have a measure with which to average them. All right? And then you can build your current T plus up from below by glomming together a bunch of things like that in a nice way. So it's a little complicated. But I think worth understanding. I think it's really something new from complex dynamics. And I should say, since he's here too, that this is ultimately an idea of Bedford, Leibovitz, and Smiley. But it's been refined successively by Cantat, by Dujardin, by Dutillain, and I apologize to the people I forgot. So where I really learned about it well is by reading Dujardin's theses. Theses are great things, not just for the people who write them. A lot of the things I've learned for the first time came from a thesis. Got one more. Okay, so I want to explain something about the proof of this theorem. Let's see what we can do. Let's just suppose drastically that X is P2. Okay? What's that? X is projective. Yeah, I'm assuming X is projective throughout. Yeah, otherwise you don't have hyperplanes to work with, hyperplane sections. Okay, so let's suppose X is P2 to start with. Let's pick a random point, P and P2, a line L in P2, and let pi from P2 minus P to L be a linear projection. So if you choose, yeah.
So sorry, Jeff, where are you putting
out the T? I'm going to prove that T plus is laminar, right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Proof always in quotes. Right, so what the picture is here, if you move P off to the end of the y-axis, okay, what the picture is pi, and you make L here, you put P out here, then pi is just projection down to the horizontal axis. And then what you do for your poly disks is you parse up L into disks of roughly equal size, and we'll say, let's say size epsilon here. All right? So the radius is about epsilon. Okay, so that gives you, if you let that interact with pi, you get a partition of all of your space. And now, you want to consider f to the minus n of L, or not L, of H, where H equals some other line, random line, hyperplane section. Okay. So what does that look like? It looks like, this, maybe it comes around, intersects itself, maybe it kind of shoots off out of the top sometimes, something like that. Has some things going for it, some things against it. And you see that a couple of things. So note that pi restricted to f to the minus n of h has degree, in this setting, exactly lambda 1 to the n. I think lambda 1 will be an integer now. And you get exactly lambda 1 to the n for a degree. Okay? And mostly, F to the minus N of H looks like a laminar current with respect to these poly disks. Okay? So, a connected component of, say, PJ, and these are my PJ now, these poly disks are my PJ, of PJ is good. So that connected component, I don't know, C, is good if you rule out three things. So first of all, you want that pi restricted to C is 1-to-1. Okay, so this is good. This is not, because pi is actually 2-to-1. Right here, okay, just something like that.
So your poly disks are going infinitely on
here? Right, they are, right. They're not technically poly disks, they're like delta cross C in this case, yeah. Yeah. This is also bad, right here. I said connected component, not irreducible component. So pi is not 1-to-1 here, okay? So this is, there are two kinds of bad encapsulated here, two kinds of good, depending on your, whether it's half empty or half full. So it implies C not reducible locally, and C no critical points, no ramification on C. No critical points of pi, okay? And the other thing you want to do for compactness reasons is rule out stuff like this, where you get a component that shoots way up. You want the area of C to be less than some constant small enough. Some constant small enough to give you compactness of disks with this area. Okay, essentially less than the area of one of these lines, I think. Okay, so the sum over any one of these poly disks of the currents of integration over good disks in PJ. I feel I'm inventing a whole new notation here. Certainly uniformly laminar. Okay, and it's also bounded by the restriction of T plus to PJ, or no, sorry, the restriction of F to the minus N of H over PJ. Okay, maybe I should normalize or something. And after normalizing by mass, so you just gives you a current, you divide by the mass, you get current of mass 1 or epsilon squared, however you want to do this. This current lies in a compact family, in a very compact family. And what do I mean? So compact is just because of the mass bound. But very compact means that any sequence of disks taken from a whole bunch of such currents is going to have limit points because of the area bound here. Okay? So implies any sequence of such currents has limit points, and the limits are also uniformly laminar currents. All right? And this is because as things are converging, the disks are also converging. You have to argue a little bit to get the uniform laminar. It's not as plain as, well, it's not as obvious as I first thought. So what do I want to say next? So I've just been mostly considering one particular pullback of H. Letting N go to infinity and extracting a convergent sequence, you get something. You get a current, a uniformly laminar Tj less than or equal to T plus restricted to Pj on Pj. So you get some uniformly laminar currents that are going to be your approximates. But maybe they're zero. I mean, this is a worry. If you normalize, particularly as you let n go to infinity and do the right normalization, I guess what I'm worried about is you might get zero for a limit here. So knowing that you don't get zero is tantamount to showing that you didn't have to throw away too many components here. Okay? So to see that this mass is small on average for an average J, on average, you show that there are not too many bad components. In fact, I sort of had three types of bad components, and it turns out that there are roughly lambda 1 to the n of each type. So in fact, there, for each n, there exists less than or equal to c lambda 1 to the n bad components where c, so this is bad components over all pj at once. I'm counting all the bad components over all the pj, where C is independent of epsilon. Okay, it has nothing to do with the size of the poly disk. So this means that the number of total components depends highly on epsilon. It's going to infinity as you let epsilon shrink. For a fixed n, it's going to infinity. But the number of bad components doesn't change as you shrink epsilon. That's the key. All right? So how do you get this bound? Well, it's a little bit different argument for each case. But take points like this. Take ramification points for the projection. So that's bad number 2, is it? It's like the second kind of bad point. So the number of ramification this is an EG of how you get this bound. The number of ramification points for pi restricted to f to the minus n of h it's given by Riemann Hurwitz. It's the number of critical points of pi 1 compose f to the minus n from h onto L. Okay, so it's a map from P1 to P1, and the number of critical points of such a map is roughly the degree of the map by Riemann Hurwitz. So it's roughly the degree of pi, which is lambda 1 to the n by Riemann Hurwitz. Okay, so that's sort of how you argue this bound. In the other cases, you can take care of in analogous fashions. Now, once you have that, hence, the sum, so there exists about lambda 1 to the n over epsilon squared components in total, and C lambda 1 to the n are bad, where C does not depend on epsilon. So this implies that the difference between T plus and the sum over all these Tj is really on the order of epsilon squared. Okay? And that's it. So that's the proof. You let epsilon shrink to zero. Okay. I really like this. This is from a paper of Dujardin. Right. Okay. There was a further point I wanted to make. I was trying to remember what it was. Notice that I haven't just shown that this current is laminar. So laminar just requires some good approximation for each epsilon. What I've got is effective estimates. I can tell, if you give me an epsilon, I can tell you how big you need to take these things in order to get your approximation here. And that turns out to be this particular estimate, this epsilon squared, is essential, as far as I know, for applications. All right. And if I have enough time, I can give you some indication of why it's relevant. Okay, so that's it for the proof of the theorem that T plus is laminar. So finally, we've got an invariant current T plus for F upper star, and a corresponding invariant current T minus for F lower star. Maybe this is the time for one aside about non-invertible maps. For non-invertible maps, things for T plus go through more or less the same way, as always. T minus is much worse than T plus for non-invertible maps. In many ways, it lacks some uniqueness properties. It's really difficult to say anything directly about T plus without some kind of reference. I mean, about T minus without referring to T plus. Okay, you do prove everything about T minus from duality type arguments. And then when you go for laminar structure, it doesn't have laminar structure in the sense that the disks are disjoint. The disks are allowed to intersect each other. Now this is, I think Dean calls this woven structure, right? What's worse is that this woven structure is highly, it's not obvious that it's unique. It could be unique, we don't know. But in general, it's not at all clear that the disks are unique, whereas they turn out to be for T plus. Okay, so it's a much worse current. But anyhow, to get back on track, from T plus and T minus, you let allow, in a sense, you know, as if all you had to do was give T plus and minus permission and they would wedge each other. you let mu be the wedge product of T plus and T minus. Okay? And then the question is how to make sense of this. Okay? Well, there are ways. It's in pluripotential theory, people do wedge singular things. They do multiply singular things. There are ways of doing it. None of them are, as far as we know, perfectly suitable for this context. Okay, classically, you have everybody's favorite method since Bedford and Taylor got going in this subject. Maybe even go a little before that. I don't know. So method number one is you have T plus is omega plus DDC G plus. G plus is some pluri subharmonic function. So if you can define the wedge product, so morally, mu is equal to omega wedge T plus DDC of G plus wedge, omega wedge T minus, plus DDC of G plus wedge T minus. Okay, but T minus is closed, so you can write it this way. So you just write this as product here. And the thing, the observation is that this makes sense as soon as G plus is L1 with respect to the trace measure of T minus. Okay, which makes sense. If G plus is in the trace measure of L1 of T minus. And I'm being a little cavalier with my form omega. It's playing several roles, not all of which are compatible here. Okay, so what are the virtues of this method? It's well understood. It's actually symmetric in T plus and T minus. In other words, this works if and only if it works with the plus and the minus switch. It implies that the measure mu is a probability measure, F invariant, ergodic, and does not charge curves. Which is nice for meromorphic maps because meromorphic maps are lousy on curves. In particular, it doesn't charge points. That's actually the hard thing to prove. Getch and I did this in a paper. Vice, it's hard to get the entropy bound. Well, they're actually... actually, sort of two vices. One is this is kind of hard to verify in most circumstances. So, hard to verify in most circumstances, and it's hard to estimate, let alone compute, the entropy of this thing. Okay? So, and the reason it's hard. I mean, from my point of view, is that you've got nice geometric structures associated with the currents T plus and T minus. You have these laminar structures, okay? And what you'd like to know is that intersecting the currents just means intersecting the disks in the laminar structure, okay? So that the intersection was in some sense geometric, not just analytic. And it's hard to show that. From just this condition right here. If you have that, then you get there's sort of nice dynamics theorems that just give you the entropy almost immediately. Okay, so method number two. So method two, T plus wedge T minus is equal to omega wedge D of T plus T minus. Okay? So you don't do DDC, you do D instead. And this makes sense. If in some sense of the derivatives of this are in L2 with respect to T minus. So if DG plus wedge DZ G plus wedge T minus is finite. Confused about bi degree? What did I do? Oh, yes, yes, thank you. D of DC G plus, sir. Omega, wedge T minus. Did I make the same mistakes before? No. You should just look at the other board. No. It's your fault. No. Okay, you're right.
Focus on what you're writing.
Right, don't pay attention to me. Right. Okay. So this is a condition, this is actually somewhat stronger. As I've written it, it's somewhat stronger than this condition. So, you might think that that's, you know, a step backwards. If you can't verify the first condition, why would you verify this? It's easier to verify in a direct sense. I won't go into that. And it implies that T plus wedge T minus is geometric. Okay, and what I would really love to do, but my morals forbid it, is to show you why it's geometric. So this uses this estimate I put up before. But the difference between T plus and its uniformly laminar approximates is less than or equal to epsilon squared, where epsilon measures the size of the polydiscs. Okay? It definitely uses that. This fits just perfectly with this sort of thing. But I'm out of time, so I stop there.